you yesterday in my group session. I'm Gail Bunger. I'm a nurse. Been a nurse for 30 years, work at Children's Hospital in Seattle in an administrative position, and also serve on the ethics committee at the hospital. And have for some time spent some thought on ethical kinds of issues. Yesterday, we looked at something relatively in the scheme of things, non-controversial, that's advanced directives, living wills. And one of the things is I thought about some of your comments yesterday was some feeling of lack of trust in healthcare systems and healthcare providers. And I was struck with that, and I remember April pushing me on why I hadn't done mine, and my response was probably denial. Though I also think it may be more like that of the nurse I was talking about yesterday, in that maybe because I work with healthcare professionals every day, I also have a greater sense of trust in people and the systems, and maybe that may be what contributes to my not having done it. I don't know. Because I also am saying I think it's a good exercise. But I think that, as I also said yesterday, I think the exercise of doing it and discussing it is probably every bit as important as this document that you actually carry with you. Today,
something I thought too yesterday that I think, I'm not sure everybody understands that, I mean, just because you fill that out doesn't mean that you can't change it. If you decide a couple of years later that you don't like what you have on it, you can do it again. So
absolutely.
I don't think you're locked into it.
Absolutely not locked into it. You can rip it up at any time, you can change it at any time.
I really identified with the other thought that you had, that I'm going to be able to do that for myself. I had that belief that I'm going to go right on through. That may be a false belief, right? It may not happen that way.
I also had the thought after we left that someone brought up that it should be made when you get older. And really, it should be made when you're young, because as you get older, the doctors kind of back off. When you're younger, your family is there to say, do more.
Mm-hmm. Well, today we're going to get into, I think, something that's a little more controversial. And what's your name?
Mary Jo.
Mary Jo is hoping for a real good argument. So we'll see if we get into that. I think it's an emotional issue, whether one's on one side or the other. If we're all on the same side, I think it's an emotional issue. And that's what I want to talk about, is physician-assisted death or physician-assisted suicide. And I guess before I start, I'd like to hear what, I think there's been a lot of press in the paper lately on what kinds of things people are aware of about the physician-assisted suicide. What have you heard? What do you know? Is it just COVID?
I know that Dr. Gavorkian is in a bad situation most of the time. Getting a lot of press.
Is that what most of you have as experience with physician-assisted death?
Yeah.
And I know that the state's hearing a lot on whether they have any laws that apply, perhaps quite strict laws, but it's one of those things where it depends a lot on where they are.
And we mentioned yesterday, too, that Washington State tried to pass one, just this last election, to pass one, and I'm sure it'll be on the next ballot, and there'll be more people for it eventually.
It was pretty split, wasn't it? The vote.
Yeah, very split.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Netherlands has an official policy on euthanasia. And we'll talk a bit about the contrast between that and some of the criteria that's being discussed if we go to a system here that's more legal, what it might look like here. Let me put this in, there's two conflicting ethical principles that come into play in this dilemma. And the two are the principle of autonomy, the individual's right to control his own life, her own life, versus the sanctity of life itself. And I think I labeled this session Sanctity of Life, Sanctity of Death. And I wish Dave were here again today, because he was provoking some questions yesterday about that physician obligation to promote life, to be there to support life. And I think what we get into in this kind of dilemma is this conflict between how do you support life when the individual knows that he, she does not want life supported and is incapable of taking their own action to get out of it. And then we also can get into the whole morality of suicide issues in and of themselves. There's a framework that I'd like us to start thinking of. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine relatively recently, where a physician's writing about a good death and a medical failure. And this particular physician describes a good death as, he has two criteria for a good death. Two things have to happen. One is that there will be medical interventions that have been used appropriately to postpone the time of a person's death, so that they live what he calls a natural lifespan. And he describes it in biographical terms as opposed to a chronological term. Take, for example, what we're able to do with CF patients now, cystic fibrosis children. Their lifespan now goes all the way up into early adulthood and some even into their 30s, whereas in the past their life was very limited. They died as children. But that would be what's considered appropriate medical interventions to extend life, to give the individual as much good life as that person can have. And then the second part of a good death is when death becomes unavoidable. It no longer is possible to sustain life, but the dying process itself is free of pain and other burdens, and that the individual is able to be surrounded by those people who are able to provide psychological, spiritual comfort. That's a good death. A medical failure, then, according to this physician, would be when you've done number one, and you think you're into number two, but you can't achieve it. For whatever reason, you cannot achieve this comfortable death. At which point, then, these physicians in these articles are stating that we should be able to then speak to the need for a physician-assisted death. And they describe seven criteria that need to be in place for this to occur. So I could start by listing what they call the seven criteria. Actually, it's a different set of doctors that are listing the seven criteria. It's all in the same journal. This is from November 92 of New England Journal of Medicine, if you want to look it up. The first criteria is that it needs to be an incurable disease with severe, unrelenting suffering, that the dying process is agonizing, and that the outcome of this process is death. That's the first criteria. You wouldn't begin to think about being involved in a physician-assisted death without that criteria being present. Second would be that...
Excuse me, Gail, is the suffering only physical, or is it that gray area of mental suffering as well?
I would put it in the gray area, because the other thing I think, and again we alluded to it last night, is I don't think people are just afraid of pain, but they're afraid of the loss of their dignity, the kind of ways in which they can die a horrible death. Let me read you another statement that these physicians start with. It's not idiosyncratic, selfish, or indicative of a psychiatric disorder, for people with an incurable illness to want some control over how they die, the idea of a noble, dignified death with a meaning that's deeply personal and unique is exalted in great literature, poetry, art, and music. And I think that speaks to beyond pain control. I think it speaks to that dignity.
Yeah, would extreme old age be the same as, would that come to number one? I mean, if someone is 90 and very frail and, you know, bedridden and hardly able to make decisions with the hand.
Where would you put that one?
Well, it's not incurable to do, huh? No.
Should we start debating now?
No, right now.
let's lay these all out here.
Oh,
we can pick and choose the ones we want to get out of.
It may be severe, unrelenting suffering.
Oh, yeah, yes. You bet.
The second criteria is that the physician must assure that the suffering request is not the result of inadequate comfort and care. That we are able to do a lot to relieve pain, to provide comfort in the process of dying. And that every person deserves that comfort and care. The third is that the patient must clearly and repeatedly request to die rather than suffer. It can't be an impulsive, I wish my life were over, one-time kind of thing. It needs to be that ongoing dealing with the suffering and being unable to tolerate it, and to repeatedly request. The fourth is that patient judgment must not be distorted by something else that's going on. And these docs are suggesting that you get a psychological or psychiatric consult. I think it might be... Pardon? Well, there are times when people can become depressed by their situation, and if you deal with the depression, they'll be able to deal with their situation. I mean, their depression may be a normal response to what's a real horrible situation, but if you go in and support the depression, then perhaps they can deal with the rest of their situation. Fifth, carried out only in the context of a meaningful physician-patient relationship. This is one of the reasons why the physicians do not particularly care for what Dr. Kevorkian is doing, apart from a lot of other things that he might be doing around publicity. But he is not these people's physician. He comes into relationship with them for the purpose of assisting their suicide. It's also interesting, if I understand the Netherlands model, it's a subspecialty now to be the suicide people. And they come in at your request and they take care of it, and then obviously they're out of your life. They weren't in your life before either. It's also interesting that reading some of this stuff that most of the physicians and the discussion I've read about would like to see that the means to end one's life is put in control of the individual, so that they are given what they need, and that may be all they need in order to tolerate their natural dying process. They may never need to use it. It also frees them up to be still able to do it when they want to do it. It talks about in Netherlands that, you know, if you've called this person and at the last minute you wimp out, you know, they're not going to let you call them again. You don't get another chance at that. And it would be absolutely normal to have ambivalence at those moments. That's totally a normal response.
I was talking with David yesterday or the day before about you guys watching people bungee jumping at the state fair and saying that about a third or more of them we'd go up to the top and walk down.
There would be a normal ambivalence. The other thing is that people are suggesting someone should never die alone. And this gets to be one of the arguments of why you should make it legal, because now in order to protect the physician and family, these suicide, physician-assisted suicides occur with that person being alone, so no one else can get blamed for it or held in a court for it. Six, a required consult, and in, again, in these articles, they ask that a second physician be involved in making the decision. I think it would be more meaningful to say that that consult needs to be perhaps one's spiritual advisor. And seventh, documentation, that indeed this, there is going to be a track record of what went on, that this was a deliberate thing, and it is well documented what goes on in that process. These have been suggested by some physicians as proposed clinical criteria for these guidelines. Still, we're still in the area now of a physician making available to an individual what they would need in order to terminate their life, as opposed to active euthanasia, where the physician would actually do the deed, as it were. Which of these do you want to take on?
I just want to ask, I don't know of any, there are no states, are there, that do have this
in place.
In place right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, legally.
Are there?
I
don't think so.
In Minnesota, Wisconsin.
No, but there are states where there are, there are states where, in fact, Michigan was one of them. The point when Morgan had gone there, there wasn't any sanction for his doing.
Yeah.
Other than regular felonious.
Right. They're trying to get
so
him
there
before
are
he can't
move. I think it's in fact in New Zealand there's plenty that don't have any.
It also has
not been an issue, so nobody got around to hiking out.
So yeah, okay. They did a survey, a general social survey of people. This is normal population, average population. In 1978, 60% of the population felt that when a person has a disease that cannot be cured, doctors should be allowed by law to end the patient's life by some painless means if the patient and family request it. And in 1991, that went up to 72% of the population answering it that way. And some other stats I pulled out about physicians. Here we go, internal medicine. And I didn't write down the year this was done. They polled 1,000 physicians, received replies from 400, and 20% of those said they had assisted a patient in dying.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with not having it legal is that then you don't have open discussion about who's doing this and who's not doing this and what works and what doesn't work and all that kind of thing. Now let me do just a few more statements about what some of the ethicists are saying. This will be very brief. They're across the spectrum too. There's the ethicists like McCormick, who is a Catholic moral theologian, who maintains that autonomy can never be an adequate reason to step over the line and be party to someone's death. And that what people are really asking for is that they don't want to be dependent as they're dying, and that if we truly live in an agape love relationship with the people who are dying, they wouldn't need to feel that way. That's part of his argument. That the caregivers then must be into unlimited caring, and the recipient must be into absolute trust. It sounds like an ideal.
Wow. Angel besides.
Yeah. Cass, who's a physician philosopher, believes that the deepest ethical principle is not the freedom or the autonomy of the patient, but the dignity and the mysterious power of human life itself, and the physician hands need to remain clean, they must not kill. Then there's Brock at the Hastings Center, who says we should be looking at intent rather than actual acts, and that we should be evaluating the motives, and that if to discontinue life-sustaining treatment or to provide a means to death can be the most merciful, loving act that someone could do for someone else. And Mark Dentley, in an article called Covenantal Ethics and Care for the Dying, and states that assistance with dying can be consistent with deep Christian compassion if it takes place in the context of mercy. Mercy is inextricably tied to relationships, particularly covenantal relationships. And he again goes back to the motivation and that trusting covenantal relationship between the physician and the patient. Then the deep and profound connection of covenant between doctor and patient can the experience, one can experience mercy and grace. So that's some of the more philosophical discussions around it, and then some of the reality we just talked about, that the physicians are doing it, and then we have the population saying they think it should be at least. So, now, come on, Mary Jo, what do you want?
I want the option.
You want it to be legal?
Yes, I want it to be legal. I don't want to have, if that were my choice, I do not want to have to die alone. I do not want to have to worry that some doctor that I love is going to go to jail, nor do I want my family on the spot. I mean, they have to call the coroner, and I'm very concerned about that. I have a nurse niece who says, I'll be there for you, Mary Jo. And I said, but I don't want you to go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And it may never happen, but I want to know that there's that option. Yeah, I see hundreds of people in a nursing home every week of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And something has happened to me as a result of that. I don't want to be there.
Yeah.
If that's what you call living, then I have the wrong... Then my view is very different from that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I admit that my involvement with hospice is very much... They object to missionary because they say that if you have pain control, hospice would stand behind and say, you aren't going, it's going to be quality time for you with your family. And in that one instance, I believe they are able to do that in many instances, to provide that quality time and good care. But I think of Alzheimer's, and I'm not surprised that when that woman had the diagnosis that she went to Kabarkian, he was the only one available.
Tony, I want to ask you about that, but wasn't the prognosis for her that she might have another 5 to 7 really good years before she would begin to deteriorate? Would that make a difference to you?
I'm not sure. I've seen a floor full of Alzheimer's people. Boy, and talk about something. When it begins, they know they're losing it, and boy, are they frustrated. The fear on those people's faces until they've crossed a line, to me, is just incredible.
What line is it that they cross?
Do you talk about that one?
Where they really don't know.
Yeah, where they're, you know, there is a line after which they really don't care, but oh, that beginning looks like, oh.
This is smoking.
Well, and the other things one.
Oh, true.
Each person.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I got the diagnosis.
And I have 5 years. But the implications that you might be aware of the weight and burden on the loved person who's going to care for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I watched one half of a couple. I mean, it's a load like you can hardly imagine.
It's just crushing.
Person has just leaned into it like you know, Jesus himself.
And I would think, Jerry, if you waited even a few years until things had progressed, then you would be at a place where people would question your capability to make that decision.
Oh, you bet they would. And I'm going to take control, Billy, but in another way.
Right. You know, this is an absolute... I don't really believe what I'm saying, but it's kind of like if somebody gets a cold and they say, oh, this could lead to pneumonia and that could lead to death, you don't want to say, okay, I've got a cold, I may as well go call Dr. Kevorkian.
And do it right today.
Right, because it'll save me from all this possible. That's by far an extreme of what I really am saying, is that I think if somebody I really love had a diagnosis that 5 years from now they would begin to have diminished mental capacity and that Alzheimer's would then rapidly envelop them, that I would want the next 4 years with that person and then deal with it.
Well, plus we don't know if it's Alzheimer's until someone dies.
No, listen, I'm pretty sure.
There's a lot they can do. Not always. I worry about everything.
We've had a client who had been diagnosed, and when, you know, she died, indeed it was not.
Mm-hmm. Do you have something to share?
Yes, there's one little, I brought the book.
All right.
Yeah, Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, where Sokyel Rinpoche takes the Tibetan Book of Dying and he translates it again for our culture and our time. And I've read just the first 50 pages, and then there's an appendix in the back, and I haven't got to the middle where he's giving us an opportunity to look at an option. But in the back, there is the question about staying alive, and in one little paragraph, I thought this was interesting food for thought, says, is there any point in keeping people alive artificially when they otherwise would die? The Dalai Lama has indicated one essential factor, the state of mind of the dying person. And he quotes him by saying, from the Buddhist point of view, if a dying person has any chance of having positive, virtuous thoughts, it is important, and there is a purpose for them to live just a few minutes, even just a few minutes longer. He highlights the stress on the family in such a situation. And then he says, if there's no chance for positive thoughts, and in addition, a lot of money is being spent by the relatives, simply in order to keep someone alive, then there seems to be no point. But each case must be dealt with individually. It's very difficult to generalize.
Mm-hmm. When was that written?
This was written
Oh, boy.
In a sense it was, but it's really written 3,000.
Oh, the original Tibetan Book of the Dead, I think before Jesus.
It might interest you that a relocated Tibetan woman came to live in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
And she had been a nurse in Tibet, and she got a job in our small Hudson, Wisconsin nursing home. And she was just absolutely irate at all the way we extend old people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Without any, and she felt the other part was missing. And I think she has quit the job. I mean, she could not tolerate it. Mm-hmm. I thought about this last night, and I'm really anxious to read this book.
Yeah, it's great. I've had this book for a month, and I read 50 pages because one paragraph is so much food for thought. It's overwhelming. Shut it and think about it for a while.
Now, your point is, it would be where my husband would be, but I trust him implicitly. So if I say had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, or that was my suspicion, I am sure that then he would carry out my wishes if we came to an agreement that yes, let's give the next 4 years a try. I wouldn't have to fret that if my mental capacities were diminished, that then I would not have anybody to support me, and my children would also. And we've talked about this many times.
So you'd see yourself supported for those 4 years, and
then yes, somebody... yes, and I think. You know, what you're saying is you would want those 4 years, so would my husband. So we do die alone, but it affects a lot of other people. Happily.
Mm-hmm.
I've been squirming and uncomfortable with this whole conversation. I haven't been able to figure out why, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that while we're sitting here talking about this, which is, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but fairly clinically, the thing that just hit me is, why am I so nervous about this, is that one of the things I think I'm missing in this conversation is the underlying purpose for life in the first place. Why are we even here? And you touched on that, Jerry, and in some of your rebirthing, that people can go back and find out why they're here. And if we're not in tune with that, now we're making decisions on, gee, I think I'll end it at this point because of some list of reasons that may not at all be consistent with why we're here in the first place. And this gets into some spiritual, it's kind of interesting, because also we were talking from a spiritual and a moral point of view in making some of these decisions. And maybe one of the reasons why we're faced with, should I end it at this point, is we're not addressing and not in tune with our spirituality and complete with that, to the point that death isn't as big an issue or the way of death, because we're whole in the purpose of our life and the spiritual side of it. We're whole in the purpose of our life and the spiritual side of it, not just the physical, the disease and the mental capacity, but I'm also whole, if you will, with my creator or my spiritual side. And that abandoned, I don't want to call them totally abandoned, elderly people, that side of that equation has also been abandoned too. The spiritual and the a higher purpose for even them having the disease. And while I was struggling with that, I then couldn't put it back into this perspective anymore. I guess that's where I was squirming. I just wanted to throw that out on the table. Because it seemed like it was just the conditions for, and they were all physical, for deciding when to pull a plug. Why would I want to pull a plug for my life purpose? So I just wanted to introduce that. There's a lot with you that could share with that, but I just wanted to put that part of the equation on the
Yeah. I have a problem, and maybe some of my thinking is parallel with yours, but I guess in a couple of sentences, we don't have the ability to create life. Where do we feel we have the right to end life? There's no way that we can create any form of life.
Are you against capital punishment then as well?
No, I'm not against capital punishment.
What about war?
Yeah. War is bad, no question about it. But if I had to go to war to protect our country, I wouldn't. I don't believe that there should be wars, but I think as long as we're all human beings and we all have a certain amount of greed, there will always be wars.
And that's the other one, abortion.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
See, my question there is always, why do we have the right to continue life? Why do we have the right to put somebody on all these tubes? Why do we have the right to put a stomach tube in somebody so that that person can't die but has to lay there and linger on and on and on? We knew a man who went on dialysis
And the doctors came to the decision that it was time to stop this. And the man said no, and he went on that dialysis. It just went on and on and on and on. And, you know, let me just imagine 3 years of dialysis, the cost of that.
Sounds lighthearted, but...
You know, why did we have the right to begin that? Is that any worse than ending a person's life?
Not right.
I think it's the same
thing. But again, it was his decision.
Whose decision? It sounds like this happened to this person, the stomach tumor or whatever.
The doctor, the dialysis.
They started the dialysis. You know, without people thinking about it many times. I mean, many times a stomach tube is put in without any discussion with anybody. You can't get it out there, you know?
We had an experience with a much loved pet this last year that was really interesting to me because I kept using it as a metaphor for human beings. We had an old dog that had lived in our family as long as our children were young. And I sort of saw her as encompassing our young years of the family. And she got a urinary thing that was really killing her. She was really, really uncomfortable. And one morning at 4 o'clock, she woke me and she was coughing and heaving, and I knew she had to go outside. And I let her out, and I took my eyes off for a few seconds. And it was a ghostly night, and it was kind of interesting because all of a sudden the young puppy came alive. She took off barking out into the dark, and she was sort of out there with these creatures running under the trees. And I went back in to get medicine from the vet, which we had been given, and I came to find her. I couldn't find her, and she had sort of disappeared under the fir trees of the neighbor's house, and she was lying down. And I came to get her and pick her up and bring her in the house, and she didn't want me to do that.
I could tell
she didn't want me to do that, but I did it. And I brought her in the house, and the vet's office opened at 8, and I knew that I was going to sit there with her from 4 till 8. And I put her down, and this dog, all of you who have pets, you know these stories, I mean, it was like she was sort of talking to me. And when the vet's office opened, I was there. And he took a look at her and he said, I think I can put her on glucose or something, and you know, you can, and something will, you know, will bring her back. So in all hopefulness, I went off to work. My mind went off of the dog, and I thought at the end of the day, we'll go home and we'll get her and we'll bring her home. Which David and I did. We went down there at 5 o'clock and they brought out this dog who looked at us. I mean, she was on this steel table and she sort of looked up and she was so glad to see us, and you could see that she could not wag her tail. They had had her something dripping into her all day, and I thought, I left her there all those hours while they did this to her. She was in a cage, which she'd never been in before. And all this was going on. I was sure. Kept thinking about all of this stuff. And the vet just said, you know, you can take her home tonight, but I don't think she's really going to make it. And he said, I think you have the decision that people make, this kind of thing. And he said, I'll give you as long of her as you want. And David and I sat there and sort of looked at this dog and held her and thought about our kids. And I couldn't sit there for the 20 minutes that the vet had given us. He said, you can meet with her for 20 minutes. I couldn't watch her suffering as she couldn't even stand up on the steel table, and we had nowhere else to go. And so, you know, we did make that decision, and we wrapped her up and put her in the trunk, and the story gets even just quite strange. And Allison could simply not believe that we did this. But we wrapped her up and took her home, put her in the trunk, and Allison was working here at Golden Village. And she was going to be home in 12 days. And we had been hoping that the dog would live until she came home so that we would be able to put her away together. And you know, so Allison's coming home on the train. I wrote to her right away that the dog hadn't waited for her. But I said, the thing I'm going to do.
I know.
They put her in the freezer. And I thought, you know, I don't care if Allison helps with this. I don't care, but she can choose. You know, when she gets home, we will bury this dog out in the backyard. If I'll do it, that's fine. But when Allison's home, she can choose if she wants to be there or not.
Mm-hmm.
Which we ultimately did, and Allison, I mean, she is, I mean, when she talks about it, she is really glad that we did that. But she'll still just shake her head.
That's crazy, Mary.
And then empty freezer. But anyway, I've written about this story in certain ways. I wrote a prose piece and then I wrote a poetry piece because it really made me think about the death and dying issue and how I could not bear to watch this dog suffering. I couldn't even take the time that the vet had told us we could take with her to say goodbye. And I couldn't do it.
You need to know something else about this dog. Dogfish down here look cartoons about.
They would always the water dish in the house and down under the counter, and they would cut out dog cartoons and put up.
Those are the kind of dogs that think they're people.
Well, it is kind of interesting because I grew up on a farm, and on a farm our dogs were always outside and not indoor dogs. And I get our oldest daughter really scolded me about the fact that when we had our first dog, when she was young, we wouldn't let the dog in the house. It was an outdoor dog. And she thinks we're immune to it. But it's, I don't know what you do with it.
Anyway, you say something?
Well, I just wanted to comment, although that's such a moving story, it's hard to talk about. One of them is, I think that in some ways I see a real difference between withholding or avoiding life support measures and something more active. I think that's not the same. And I do know how particularly older people who are facing the prospect of, that at some point something could go wrong with them. And in our congregation, there are a number of elderly women who will say, the last thing I'm going to do is call 911. I'm not going to let, if something happens to me, the last thing I'm going to do is get into a hospital or even get the EMTs there.
Yeah.
As soon as they're there, stuff's going.
It all
there's
happens.
Nowhere. You
that's
you can't go in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as soon as you get something in you, they're not going to take it out.
Yep.
And that one, I think, is one kind of issue that because it's there's something quote natural about or unnatural about technology, that's easier for us to say. Well, that was mm-hmm. But even people stopping eating, you know, let's mm-hmm. not even start brewing stuff in them if they don't want to eat. But the proactive one, I think, is the one that's a lot harder. Okay, here's what you need to do this when you decide that it's time. And I guess that I think we are so acculturated to the choice that I can't, it's hard for me to imagine, particularly when we do have things like abortion, how we can't have this. I mean, sort of so much in the same
yeah.
logical world. Now, it really is, it seems to me that we value autonomy so very highly in our culture that it's really quite striking. Whether we should value it that highly, I think, is maybe an open question. But I do think that we all need just to cultivate the value of life that is not productive. I think one mm-hmm. of I really, earlier on when we got the what about if you're just lying there and you're limp in bed one, as far as I'm concerned, the problem with that one is that we just don't value the presence of people enough, and that I would like us not to. I'd like us to have a cultural values if maybe that person still had the choice not to live any longer, but it would be nice if we lived in a world where the angel could be there, where you could go ahead and someone is going to be just glad that you're there, even if all you're doing is lying. But we're such a productivity-oriented society mm-hmm. and such a kind of control of our lives oriented society. I think maybe that's the problem. I think that connects with the spirituality thing. Mm-hmm.
But don't we have a problem then in this instance that Gay mentioned about the person being on dialysis for 3 years? Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a choice in terms of dollars spent.
Oh, that's another, I think that's a different, I think we're talking in the setting today about the, it strikes me, we're not, this is not the ratio, this, we're not here in the limited dollars. I don't see anything in this discussion that's the limited dollars discussion.
Right, we do that one on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a genuine, I think that there is a genuine limited dollars discussion to have, and maybe it intrudes on today, but I thought that the discussion today was framed in terms of,
what isn't very often the older person, or the old person in a nursing home, indeed a dollar issue. If we spend in those last few months of our lives, the biggest percentage of dollars spent on health care. I mean, my mother's paying $3,500 a month.
You save up all that money.
And that's not the highest.
All of a sudden.
No.
Isn't that an American issue, though? I spent a month in India in January, and they say the only way you can talk about or experience India is to experience it. You have to be in it. And I don't know how else to explain it. I was in a town that I thought was about a couple hundred thousand people, and I found out later there's 1.2 million people in this town.
I see.
And it's like they're everywhere. They are everywhere, in your face. But it's not an issue over there of how much money do you spend to keep an older person alive. But it is in the United States.
Because we have children dying on the street that aren't even having a chance to live. You know, we don't have endless dollars in this country.
They don't have dollars, period.
That's true.
A typical person there will make about, in today's wages, about $3 to $3.50 a day. If they make 300 rupees, which is $10, that's a lot of money for them. And so there isn't much money there either.
And they have children dying in the street. In India.
So when you say it's not an issue,
it's not an issue of how much money do you spend to keep old people in
the right, because
and that's why I think it's an American issue, because we've elected to use money as the vehicle to keep old people around rather than take them into our homes and have them die with the family.
And setting them apart.
I think I have more fear of going to a nursing home than I have of going to a hospital and being in the hands of whoever might be in that hospital. I would think I would feel better than I would in the nursing home. I have a terrible fear of nursing homes. I just don't want, I just don't want anything to do with them. And people had talked about taking out nursing home insurance. I just shudder.
But you know, my mother's money is going to run out.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Then it's taxpayer dollar that's going to keep her there. Now, you can say that is my response, you know, that, all right, if I'm concerned then about that dollar value to keep mother there, I do have the choice to take her to my home. But let's say I'm not going to take her to my home and she's there, then there isn't endless taxpayer dollar for to go on and on.
Well, I would certainly say that there are a whole set of issues I think they're much more painful than this one. If we think this one is tough, that one is the real rub, because it calls on the benefits and the costs aren't internalized. To some extent, in this part of the model, we're making, we're talking about things where it's our choice because it's our suffering or our life, and our loved ones who are kind of in the context of the support system. Whereas the other one is one where you're doing the trade-off between support for children and support for elderly people. But I think I guess the reason I think it's that's a good discussion to have. I think that if you put the two of them together, you're just going to get less productive thought. You know, that somehow I think in terms of thinking, it's probably helpful to think about what you think about this one without thinking about that one, and then think about that one. I'm not trying to say don't bring it up now, but to sort of say that I think because the issues that are raised in that one are so different.
Certainly, than this. So we will have probably Friday that's looking at the health care rationing, allocation of resources as our discussion.
And the Catholic Church, in fact, I think is at least pretty consistent. I have to give them real credit for that, that the Catholic Church, who is the post-abortion and opposed to these life choices in the end, is also very, very supportive of a great deal of public support for all kinds of health care. I mean, they really are on record for not kind of externalizing that cost to sort of say, well, we want this, but we don't want to pay for it. I think that they probably are collectively not as much as anybody.
The issue that you're alluding to, at least in my mind, when you talk about the Catholic Church, when I was in seminary, there were many students that said the Bible has to be understood to be a literal document that is infallibly the Word of God. There are no mistakes in the Bible. There is nothing human in it. It is totally divine. Because if you start to creep in that there is a mistake or that it's human and not divine, where will it end? You'll throw the whole thing out as being, you know, God didn't have anything to do with it kind of thing. It's like this slippery slope argument that if you don't totally, and this is what happens here with the Catholic Church. If you say yes to abortion, the next thing you'll say yes to logically will be something like euthanasia, and the next thing will be, and it's this slippery slope thing with the Catholic Church too.
I have a view of that, but that's
yeah. And that is in fact an issue for the society, that when you say 20 years ago now abortion is legal, and then you say this year now assisted death is legal, and then you say, it opens the way for saying maybe more of the Bible is human than we thought. Maybe it's all human. Maybe it's that whole cultural shift.
That's why you get disabled people, I think, very wary in a lot of it. I mean, most of the disabled people organizations got real nudgy in this.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been talking so much about the elderly, but what about end-of-life issues? Now, I haven't, statistically, I would expect that the young people who've been dying of AIDS haven't been shipped off to the nursing homes. And I don't know if it's because they have caregivers that are younger or parents that will care for them.
They have a support system many times.
A support system.
Although that, their support systems are dying too.
So yeah.
In Seattle, we have a nursing home for AIDS.
I have a friend in San Francisco who's now HIV positive, and his partner of 13 years died about 4 years ago. And he knows that what the outcome is going to be. And he said he's been to 75 funerals of friends. And he asks the question, who is going to be there for me?
That's right. That's right. I mean, that's going to work.
I said, in Seattle, we do have that one house, which is really...
But also, I work on the other end of the spectrum, and it's the very early pregnancy babies. I mean, we have... And it's before the birth that the parents are asked, you know, the chances of this child living, of this child living without support, of this child living a productive life. I mean, they're given all these statistics and then asked, should we do everything? And where I work by law, if the child is a breath, someone must come. Now, thank goodness, usually that a child is too small to intubate, or, you know, there are different criteria cutoffs, but if the parents say do everything possible for my 26-week baby instead of 40 weeks, You really, I mean, and some people do say that. And that's...
Talk about resources.
Resources, yeah, from the beginning to the end. Plus, then sometimes, for many at this time, this gestational age, it means cesarean section, so it's major surgery for a woman, and a lot of other things.
Oh.
What does it mean in projected life expectancy and difficulties that these...
It all depends. I mean, and there, and the other thing is that everybody knows somebody that has a baby who's, you know, graduating summa cum laude from Harvard.
But we're talking technology now at our hospital. Yeah. We have some technology for these newborns, these infants. One's called ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It's like being on a heart-lung machine. These babies who are born without lungs that are functioning, you put them on ECMO, their blood is, it's the strangest thing to go up and see this baby. They're not breathing because their blood is being oxygenated through a pump. And then there's these oscillating ventilators that are, what's the speed of those? You're not on any... Hundreds of, of breaths a minute for these babies. I mean, we can. They get transported to us. We don't have OB in our place like now. And so these babies get taken away from their parents, their mother, and brought to us for incredible interventions. Some of whom survive a very short time. Some of them who survive and are maintained for a few weeks. Some of them who survive and are going to be chronically ill, ventilator dependence or other things, and some who graduate from Harvard. But that's that, and that's what people keep holding out there. That's why we fly them over in the helicopter to die in our little bed away from their mother, because one out of 6,000 might make it to Harvard. I mean, you look at this and you wonder, when are we going to get... Anyway, I think our time is up for today.
And that's where the allocation of healthcare dollars are going to make some decisions.
Well, should we start that one tomorrow, the allocation?
Sounds like we started today.
I did want to ask you four paragraphs.
Okay.
Is there time for it?
Yeah.
Okay. All the great spiritual traditions of the world, including, of course, Christianity, have told us clearly that death is not the end. They have all handed down a vision of some sort of life to come, which infuses this life that we are leading now with sacred meaning. But despite their teachings, modern society is largely a spiritual desert, where the majority imagine that this life is all there is. But that any real or authentic faith in an afterlife, most people live lives deprived of any ultimate meaning. And then he goes on to talk about how this affects the environment. Because if you believe that this is the only life, then you use up everything. And then he has a quote from the Brazilian Minister for the Environment saying that we are signing IOUs, our children will not be able to pay. And we're acting as if we're the last generation. So that's the whole denial of death that's creating those big issues.
And also denial of a purpose, too.
Right.
Of our life after.
Mm-hmm. And that's what Larry Rasmussen was talking about yesterday, about we, us in our 50s, are the last generation that aren't going to have to worry about it.
Right.
And the generations to follow are going to have to worry about.
And then he said that all the Buddhist teachers, when you come and you want to study and be a practitioner, they always ask one question: do you believe in the life after this one? And they say they are not being asked whether they believe it as a philosophical proposition, but whether they feel it deeply in their heart. And the master knows that if a person believes in a life after this one, their whole outlook of life will be definite, and they'll have a sense of personal responsibility and morality. Anyhow, it goes on. It's interesting food for thought, what everything that it encompasses and of death.
One of the privileges of being a teacher is you get to do some things. And Jerry got to the story. Can I read one of my favorite poems?
Sure.
This is William Conrad, Thanatopsis. I memorized it when I was probably about 14 or 15, and I don't know it by memory anymore. Thanatopsis is, what is it?
Thanatos is dead.
To him, and excuse the sexist stuff in this, I don't dare take liberty with poetry like we do with scripture and To him who in the love of nature holds communion with her visible forms, she speaks the various language. For his gayer hour, she has a voice of gladness and a smile and eloquence of beauty, and she glides into his darker musings with a mild and healing sympathy that steals away their sharpness ere he is aware. When thoughts of the last bitter hour come like a blight over thy spirit, and sad images of a stern agony and shroud and pall, and breathless darkness in the narrow house make thee to shudder and grow sick at heart, go forth under the open sky and list to nature's teachings, while from all around, earth and her waters and the depths of air, comes a still wood. Yet a few days, and thee the all-beholding sun shall see no more in all his course, nor yet in the cold ground where thy pale form was laid with many tears, nor in the embrace of ocean shall exist thy image. Earth that nourished thee shall claim thy growth to be resolved to earth again, and lost each human trace, surrendering up thine individual being, shalt thou go to mix forever with the elements, to be a brother to the insensible rock and to the sluggish clod that a rude swain turns with his share and treads upon. The oak shall send his roots abroad and pierce thy mold. Yet not to thine eternal resting place shalt thou retire alone, nor couldst thou wish couch more magnificent. Thou shalt lie down with patriarchs of the infant world, with kings, the powerful of the earth, the wise, the good, fair forms, and hoary seers of ages past, all in one mighty sepulchre. The hills, rock-ribbed and ancient as the sun, the vale stretching in pensive quietness between, the venerable woods, rivers that move in majesty, and the complaining brooks that make the meadows green, and pour it all around, old ocean's gray and melancholy waste, are but the solemn decorations all of the great tomb of man. The golden sun, the planets, all the infinite host of heaven are shining on the sad abodes of death through the still lapse of ages. All that tread the globe are but a handful to the tribes that slumber in its bosom. Take the wings of morning, traverse Barca's desert sands, or lose thyself in the continuous woods where rolls the Oregon and hears no sound save its own dashing. Yet the dead are there. And millions in those solitudes, since first the flood of years began, have laid them down in their last sleep,